In honor of Shavuot, which we just celebrated, I wanted to at least today and next week, and we'll see if we want to continue, take a look at material that we never look at. Because we're always looking at either the Parsha or something related in Tanakh. Occasionally we'll learn a particular halachic piece or even a Haggadic piece relating to an upcoming Chag, if that's the case. But I want to look at a whole area of Agadah which doesn't get touched because it doesn't really connect halachically or calendarically with anything. And therefore, there's no usual context to teach it. But it is something that I think is quite central and core to the Agadic treasure house. So one quick word about Agadah is when we use the word Agadah, what do we mean? The word Agadah literally means telling. Same word as Haggadah. Right. What is Agadah referred to when you mean it in the context of a literature? What is Agadah?
Stories.
Stories. But the way we use it is actually broader than that. It means anything that's in the literature, rabbinic literature, which is 200 to the year 1,000 roughly, which is not halachic. So any statement which is not a legal statement, thus such as you must not, or if you do, here's what you got to do, or here's what's going to happen to you, is an agadah, which means the social etiquette and good advice and medical suggestions and stories about Avraham and about Adam and about Yehuda Maccabi and whatever stories you might have, whether we take them as literal history or not. That's all in the realm of agadah.
Is there any difference at all between agadah?
No, agadata is simply an Aramaic word for agadot, really, or agadah. And so agadot come in two flavors. One is agadah and one is midrash agadah. So whenever you use the word midrash, automatically you assume, correctly, the presence of a pasuk. Because midrash is revolving around a biblical text and is using that text to teach something. And when it's midrash agadah, it's teaching something which is not halachic. It could be an agadah filling in what's going on in that text, like why did Avraham have to leave Haran, or why did Yaakov get his name changed at that particular point, or whatever. And it may be something which is not related to that direct text, but that text is sort of the opening or the springboard. And midrashei agadah, which are almost all Eretz Yisrael composed. And composed typically somewhere between the 3rd and 8th or 9th centuries, although some of them draw from earlier material, were delivered in the Beit Knesset. And therefore we have large Agadic collections, on Midrash Agadah collections, on all 5 Chumashim and all 5 Megillot, and that's it. So there's no large Agadic collection on Yehoshua or Shmuel, or you show you how there are small little collections that were made later that were just kind of culled from different places. The reason is because they were done as part of the public reading. So we're about to read the story of Lot. Now here's an Agadah about Lot. And the Agadot that were popular kept getting repeated until finally, hundreds of years later, they got committed to writing. And by the way, in slightly different versions or grossly different versions, depending on the Agadah. Now that's all Midrash Agadah. There are also agadot, which means stories that we have that are not linked to a pasuk. And they might be stories about Adam HaRishon, or stories about Chanoch, or stories about Yeshayahu. And they might be stories about the Chachamim themselves, who are sort of the stars of the show. And what's interesting is that the stories that Chachamim tell about themselves, in a sense, is the greatest window into their lives, because it's how they're portraying their own events, their own lives. And so I want to take a look at several agadot that we have in another collection. It's a collection we're all familiar with, and that is the collection known as Talmud Bavli. Right? So Talmud Bavli, you think, should be a book of halacha, because Talmud Bavli is essentially discussions about a Mishnah. Right? You have a Mishnah, the Mishnah is law, so discussions about the Mishnah should be, how do we apply the law, what's the source for the law, why do these two people disagree, there's a third opinion we didn't know about, what's the final ruling, here's a case law, and so why would there be agadot in the Talmud? So typically, it's an Agadah that spins off of the halachic discussion, and then that spins, not out of control, but spins wildly. So for instance, you might have a halachic discussion about owning a home. And then somewhere in there, you might have an Agadah about the importance of, you know, the things you bring into your first home, you know, have the special importance. And then that the author of that Agadah might be somebody who we don't hear from too often, so the editors will put all of his Agadot together in there. And the only thing tying them together is, in fact, the same author. So here we have an Agadah, which in some circles might be the most famous Agadah in the Talmud, where the Chachamim were talking about themselves, telling the stories about themselves. And it's a very revealing Agadah. And what we're going to do is this week just learn it through. Try to understand what's going on. And it's all about conflict. And what I'd like to do next week is to look at it in the larger context and see why it is where it is, which is also not so obvious. But this is in Masachet Bava Metzia on Daf Nun Tet Amud Bet. You're looking at somewhere near the top of the page. I clipped it out so it'd have a nice big print, and I put the translation, and for the first time in, I think, recorded history, there is no backside, right? Because we're just looking at a simple text. Tana. Now, the background for this is that the Chachamim are in Yavne. This is the generation immediately after the destruction, so dated around the year 80 or 90 or something like that, in Yavne. And there is a dispute going on. The line before this tells us of the background of the dispute. The dispute is about the status of an oven. All right, they have an oven which, instead of it being a single block, was made out of joints which would fit together. Now, the oven was made out of ceramic. And the problem is that the ceramic, if it becomes tamei, you can't do anything about it. The only thing to make it
How would it become tamei?
Let's say that
a dead person touched it.
A dead, yeah, it was in contact with a dead person. It was in the Ohel HaMoed. Somebody died in that room, right? Good example.
A dead person can't touch anything.
Well, dead person's contact with it. Or it's in the room where the guy died, so it's in the Ohel.
Right.
Or you took a look at the oven and you saw that there was a dead sheretz had fallen there and was dead. So it became tameh. The only way to make a ceramic thing tahor is to destroy it. But there are various ways to destroy it which don't make it absolutely useless, but still render it no longer a kli, so it loses the tumah. And that's the case here. So there's this oven made out of joints. And what they did is they took the joints apart and they put a thin layer of sand between the joints and then put the joints back. And the question is this just the same old, with a little bit of sand, or is it a new thing? Rebbe Eliezer was of the position that it's a new thing. And everybody else disagreed. Okay, and here we go. Tana. Boto Hayom, so we're now hearing a braita. Heshiv Rabbi Eliezer kol tshuvot tshuva olam. Rabbi Eliezer gave all of the answers in the world. What does that mean? It means he was defending his position that it's tahor, and he proved it by using the classic mode of proof in halachic discussion. How do we prove things in halachic discussion? One thing we never do is say, I said so. That doesn't wash. So what do we use when trying to make a point against a disputant? We quote a Mishnah, quote a Braita, quote a Pasuk with its interpretation. We quote case law, right? And we try to say that our case is similar to that case. And the comeback will be, I've got another Mishnah, and that's closer. And it rules the opposite way. And that's how we have the discussion. So having a discussion in what we might call the usual terms of debate, and then below Kiblu Hemenu. None of the Chachamim, they didn't buy into it. So it was Rav Eliezer against everybody. We don't know, nor will we ever know, how many everybody there is, but it's the group against Rav Eliezer. Now, Amar Lahem, and now Rav Eliezer says, Im halacha kemoti, which means what? Im halacha kemoti. What? Yeah, because if the halacha follows me, but wait, we haven't decided the halacha yet, we're still discussing it. Yes, but I'm right. Right? Then, charuv ze yochiach. So the carob tree outside will prove my point. which, if you think about it, is totally outside the bounds of normal discussion. Charuv ze yochiach, and he points everything to a carob. Now, a carob tree is a huge tree. Right? It's not a redwood, but it's a huge tree. Ne'akar charuv mimkomo mea ama. So the charuv immediately picked itself up and flew 100 ama. Okay? Some people have a different version of the story where it was 400 amah that it sailed, right? And the assumption, although it's not explicit here, is that the tree replanted itself. Now, it's not at all clear, but of course it doesn't have it falling, so we don't know what happened to it. But the clear thing is clearly obvious. It's clearly miraculous.
If it can fly 100 amah,
then it can fly. Sure, and it can bear chickens as fruit also. It can do anything. Right. So now, he says, if I'm right, if the halakha follows me, then this is what should happen. And it goes flying. You are one of the students who has opposed Rebbe Eliezer and has brought all these mishnayot and braitot to disprove it. What's your reaction going to be? What are you going to do? Are you going to stick to your guns?
And wait and see.
Yeah, I'll wait and see for what? It's already happened.
Are you saying it did?
The tree already flew. Right? So now what do you do? What are your options?
You're like, okay, I guess I made a mistake.
Option one is, and why would I think I made a mistake?
Because the miracle happened.
What does one have to do with the other?
God clearly favors that position.
Right, because whose halakha are we trying to ultimately determine here? God's. What does God want? Does God want this to be Tamer Tahor?
I would say if the halakha is like me, then the tree will stay in place.
You mean the other guys would say? Then they would pull the opposite thing. So if they felt confident in pulling miracle against miracle, right, then they'd say, okay, if halakha is like me, the tree already flew. The tree will move back. Very cute. Right, right. If I'm absolutely right, an earthquake will not happen right now. Very good. I'm proving a thing. Right, but imagine, if you're on the other side of this, what are you going to do? You're either going to say, okay, I guess he's right, or else you might run for your life, because what's the next thing that's going to go flying? Instead, look what they say. Amrulo ein mevi'in raya min acharuv. You cannot bring a proof from a carob tree. What does a carob tree have to do with it? We're discussing halakha, and you're playing with carob trees. Right?
Can I say something to them? Why do they have the right to say that?
Why not? Everybody has the right to say whatever they want.
What's the support to say that you can't say that the carob tree gives me backing?
Because the carob tree doesn't give me backing. We're having a discussion about Tumah v'Tahara. What does a carob tree have to do with that?
If you look at Kanafi, you had miracles
that don't prove anything.
Isn't this the same as the Lubba Shemaim?
Well, we're getting there. We're getting there.
Why couldn't he use the miracles
to prove what?
That God supports him.
That's what he's saying. And their answer is, that's not a proof. Let's keep going. Okay? So now, one just side question on here before the obviously larger question is, how do you read a story like this? How do you understand what actually happened? You take it literally or not? Is who cares if it's 100 or 400 amot? The truth is, who cares if it's 1 amot or 100 amot? The minute that I say that tree will fly and the tree flies, I don't care how far it goes. You gotta wonder why there's these two versions. Now, that does bring us to the core issue of studying all Agadah, which is, how do we read it? If we read it, this is a story that happened exactly the way it's described, meaning if you watch the videotape, you're watching these events happen, then I get the 100 versus 400. There's two versions of the story. But if you read it instead as a metaphoric story, meaning that these elements of the story are not to be taken literally, then I gotta start wondering, well, why, who cares, 100, 400, what's the difference there? Why are you mentioning two different approaches? Yeah, and that's something that we'll leave for next week. So, Chazar v'amar lahem, and this is really, in a sense, the odder thing, is that Rabbi Eliezer is not cowed by their indifference. And he says, Im halacha kemoti, amatamayim yochichu. If halacha is like me, then the stream outside will prove my point. Chazru amatamayim lachoreim. So the stream flowed backwards. Right? So now, the clear parallel between the two of a tree uprooting itself and a stream going backwards, right, going against natural order, what?
And they answer the same way.
Which is why you kind of wonder, well, why is he doing this? Because doesn't he already know how they're going to answer? I mean, why would they be more convinced by a stream going backwards than by a tree flying?
But also, why right? is he doing this if he knows that they don't count it?
That's my question. Why do it again?
I mean, definitely. Why would he have brought the first miracle?
I don't think that's such a question. How does he know?
He answered all questions in the world. Do you think he didn't know that too?
No, all questions. That doesn't mean all questions in the world means that on this particular topic they went through all of the legal precedents and everything else, and now he's resorting to miracles. I don't think there's any question on the first one. The question on the second one: why is he doing this? What does he think they're going to suddenly say? Ooh, water, we're afraid. Amrulo emnevin rayami amatamain. And their answer is, of course, you know, same answer, which is you can't bring a proof from the stream. That has nothing to do with our question. We're discussing a halachic question. Tumah v'tahara. Is this oven a new oven or the old oven? Old oven, it's still tamei. New oven, it's not tamei anymore. That's the question. A tree flying has nothing to do with it. Streams, you're impressing us, but that's not relevant to this. Chazar v'amar lahem. Now he turns around and answers, which, by the way, again, you guys kind of ask the same question. At this point, why doesn't he give up? Because I can't convince them through persuasion, and I can't convince them through miracles. Im halacha kemoti kotlei beit midrash yochichu. Now notice, things are getting a lot more hot under the collar. Bring things much closer to home. If I'm right, the walls of the Beit Midrash will prove my point. What happened? He took kotlei beit midrash lipol. The walls started caving in. So evidently, this is either happening very slowly or very quickly, meaning either the walls are going moving slowly or else the action's happening very fast, because normally when walls start to cave, that's pretty much the end of it. They're going to fall in. All right, so they start to cave in. And then, Ga'ar Bahem Rabbi Yehoshua. Now, we never heard about this before, but if we know Mishnayot and we know Midrash Halacha, we know that when you say Rabbi Eliezer, you're almost always going to say Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehoshua, right, who are both the teachers of Rabbi Akiva. So if Rabbi Eliezer is being opposed by a group, it's not surprising that the head of that group is Rabbi Yehoshua. Now, a couple notes about them. Rabbi Eliezer was recognized in his generation. Rabbi Eliezer, by the way, he was a member of Beit Shammai, was recognized in his generation as the most brilliant mind of his generation. Rabbi Yehoshua, and we know this from a number of stories, who was also brilliant, was the people's choice. He was the favorite rabbi of everybody. And it was actually in his defense that Rabbi Gamliel was thrown out in that famous story that we may get to in this series. All right, but it was because of the way that Rabbi Yehoshua was being treated that people got angry at Rabbi Gamliel. Right? So now, Ga'ar ben Rabbi Yehoshua. Yehoshua got up and yelled at whom? The walls. He yelled at the walls. Amar lahem, im talmidei chachamim menatzchim ze et ze b'halacha, atem mativchem. And it's the same message. Talmidei chachamim are having a debate in halacha. What do you guys get involved? You have nothing to do with this. And his message, or their message, is consistent throughout, which is that halacha has its own nomenclature, has its own rules of engagement, has its own system, and nothing external to it has an impact, and miracles are of no accord here. They just don't count. So now, the Braita continues by telling the story, Lo naflu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Yehoshua, lo zakfu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Eliezer, v'adayin matin v'omdin. So the walls didn't cave in because Rabbi Yehoshua told them to stop. The walls didn't right themselves, so we're imagining now that the walls could have righted themselves because out of honor for Rabbi Eliezer, because Rabbi Eliezer told them to fall, sort of. So they're still leaning. So the point is that when this Braita is composed, you go to somewhere, maybe in Yavne, and you could see a Beit Midrash with walls leaning in. And you could still see them there. And why are they leaning in? Because they were called to fall by Rabbi Eliezer, they were called to stand by Rabbi Yehoshua, and so they're in the middle. Okay.
It's kind of interesting, because, I mean, it seems like we weren't talking about Kabbalah before, we were talking about whether or not they're right in Halakha.
Right.
But now the walls are not, presumably not, proving the halacha, they're being mechabed the different rabbis, which might be something else, no?
Right. Good. So we have to see what all this is about. And this, by the way, is the first time that the miracle component gets caught in the problem. You know, the tree is the tree. That's Gertrude Stein. Good's flying, zo. The stream is doing what it's doing. The stream hasn't changed. And the discussion pursuant to the tree and the stream happens in the Beit Midrash. Now, because things are hitting home, the miracle focal point becomes, or the miracle vehicle becomes now part of the action. And Rabbi Yeshua says, back off. And so the walls back off, but don't back off. And are caught in the middle. Rabbi Eliezer is not done. Which, again, you got to ask the question, why is he not done? Why doesn't he just pack it up at this point? So now, Chazar v'mar le mimalacha kemoti min ha-shamayim yochichu. Okay, now yeah, this is what you mentioned before. Right? If the halacha is like me, now again, what does that mean if halacha is like me? It means God wants this to be tahor. And I'll prove to you God wants this to be tahor because I will have things happen that only God could do that support my position. So a bat call. Now what's a bat call? A bat call is the last echo, the last shard of prophecy that exists. Prophecy is something that you could see as its epicenter, Mamad Har Sinai, and everything afterwards is sort of like aftershocks. And you know how aftershocks work? We all lived in LA, so we know what aftershocks are like. With time, they get weaker and more distant. And so you find that happening in Nevuah. As you get into latter Nevuah, in Bayit Sheni, you see the Nevuah is murkier and there's more weird images in it, and Zechariah needs a Navi to explain, a Malach to explain what he's seeing because he doesn't understand. And now we move into an era where there's no Nevuah, but there's a Bat Kol. Now, a Bat Kol is a heavenly voice. Right? The Bat Kol comes out and says, why are you messing with Rabbi Eliezer? And watch what they say, Halacha Kemoto B'chol Makom. What does that mean, Halacha Kemoto B'chol Makom? But literally the words. Halacha follows him
in every place.
So what does in every place mean? It can mean two different things. What?
Where there's a dispute.
But the in every place. In halachic terminology it could mean. So right, but then it would mean b'chol makom can mean in every area of law, meaning we rule like him in Mamonot and in Isurim and in Tuma and in Kodshim. In every area of law, or b'chol makom might mean a little deeper, in every place, meaning in Shamayim. Now this touches into a broad agadic or midrashic trope, which is the Beit Midrash in Shamayim. There's a fabulous agadah in Bava Metzia about Rabbi Barchana. Rabbi Barchana, and it's about the death of Rabbi Barchana. It's a spoiler alert. Rabbi Barchana was known to be an expert in the laws of Tzaraat, which is interesting because by his day they probably were no longer really happening. And there was a famous dispute going on between Kudsha Brichu and Metivta Derakia, the heavenly Beit Midrash and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Figure that one out. And in that machloket, it was about a particular case that we knew how Rabbi Bar Bachana, what his ruling was. And they couldn't settle it. So what did they do? They killed him. So he'd come to Shamayim and they would rule whatever he did, right? Halakha kemoto b'chol makom. B'chol makom here means not only on earth, but also in heaven. Right, so maybe we'll get to that agadah. But here, b'chol makom could mean in every area of law. It could mean in every place, meaning we follow him up in Shemayim, Rabbi Elazar Paskins, that's what we follow, which of course is a very odd statement to make, but it fits within the larger body of agadah. So what happened? Amad Rabbi Yeshua al Raglav. Rabbi Yeshua stood up on his... Why did Rabbi Yeshua stand up? So one reason might be because it is a bat kol. You're talking to God. You don't want to sit down. Another one might be he's making a declaration. He's standing up. I want everybody to hear this. Lo b'shamayim hi. He said three words. What are the three words? What does lo b'shamayim hi mean? What do the words mean, though? And where's it come from? What's the original context? This is how Midrash works. What? What is lo b'shamayim hi? What's the original context? The original context is when Moshe is talking to Israel, ki ha-mitzvah hazot asher anochi mitzaveh etchem hayom. Lo b'shamayim hi. Asher tomar mi yalel lanu ha-shamayim v'kachel lanu. It's not up in heaven that you would say, who's going to go up to heaven and get it for us? It's not on the other side of the sea that you're going to say who's going to get it. Rather, it's close to you. So lo b'shamayim hi here is not about how to rule in halachic cases, but rather accessibility of Torah. It's nearby. What did Rabbi Yeshua do with it? He turned it inside out and said, Lo b'shamayim hi is not a statement of its accessibility, but about its exclusivity to earth. It's not in heaven, meaning it's no longer in heaven. Right? And so now, we may not understand the full import of what he said, and therefore, my lo b'shamayim hi, we have an interjection here. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah, shekvar ninat Torah mihar Sinai. So now, what's the fuller meaning of what Rabbi Yehoshua said? It's Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah is a Talmid's Talmid of Rabbi Yochanan. This now goes to the 4th century, being the 4th century, end of the 3rd century. And he says that, what does Lo B'Shamayim he mean? That you already gave the Torah at Har Sinai. Ain anu mashgichin rabat kol. We don't pay attention to rabat kol. What does that mean, we don't pay attention? It doesn't mean that we don't believe that rabat kol is God speaking. We do. We don't pay any attention to it. God doesn't get to vote. Why? Shekvar katavta b'Har Sinai b'Torah achari rabim l'hatot. Because what did you yourself tell us in the Torah? You follow the majority. We got X, however, against one Rabbi Eliezer, and halacha follows the rabim, and Rabbi Eliezer and his miracles and God are still one vote. God gets no votes.
What about the context of achari rabim
l'hatot? That's in the context of Beit Din, right? It's certainly not. It
shows that there's about Beit Din?
In the context of Beit Din, yeah. Yeah, take a look at it. In Mishpatim. So now, the what everybody thinks is the end of the story. It's not. This is, we're right in the middle of the story. And to explain the context, we'll do that next week. But Ashkechei Rabbi Natan li Eliyahu. Now, who's Eliyahu? Who's Eliyahu Navi? And the answer is the best answer you can ever give to any question, which is?
It depends.
If you're asking who's Eliyahu Navi in Tanakh, so Eliyahu Navi is a Navi from likely Shevet Gad, who comes from Gilad, from the town of Toshev, in the times of Ahav, and creates the famine, and has the big God off at Har HaKarmel, right, and we win, and goes to Har Chorev, and then appoints Elisha as his assistant, etc. That's Eliyahu. Who's Eliyahu in pre-modern folklore? Who's Eliyahu in pre-modern folklore? What? He's... No, in pre-modern folklore. Eliyahu is the one who appears before great righteous people, either to give them some sort of reward or to highlight how great they are by showing up with some really inconvenient need and they fulfill it, or they're there at the right moment and as a result of you spending time with them, they don't get in a car accident, right? Or they show up to the Gaon Mivilna in the middle of the night to explain a difficult Yerushalmi that he's been working on for 3 days and he refuses to get the answer from him because he wants to do it himself. Gilu Eliyahu. Who's Eliyahu in Chazal? Eliyahu in Chazal is neither one of those. Eliyahu in Chazal is the go-between between Shemayim and heaven, and earth. He's the one who lets us know what's going on up there.
I mean, when does he become the precursor to the Messiah?
In Malachi already. In Malachi.
So that's,
it's in Tanakh. Right. But his function in Chazal is somewhat messianic. The famous story in Sanhedrin is from Rabbi Shimon Levi and Eliyahu. And Rabbi Shimon Levi says, "Ematai ka'atimar? When is Mashiach coming?" He says, "Go ask him in Rome." Right? But his central function in Haggadot Chazal is as the go-between to let us know what's going on up there. So, for instance, Rabbi Yossi stops into a churva to daven, and Eliyahu waits for him by the door, and then Eliyahu tells him, every time Bnei Yisrael go into shul and say, "Amen Yehesh Me Rabba," HaKadosh Baruch Hu is sad and he feels bad that he destroyed his Beit HaMikdash. When Rabbi Eviatar and Rabbi Yonatan have a disagreement about a pasuk in Shoftim, Eliyahu comes and tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is studying that parsha, and his commentary on it is Eviatar says this way and Yonatan says that way. Beautiful, beautiful Agadah. It's always about Eliyahu telling us what's going on the other side. Right? And by the way, in every one of those Agadot, the word Ben is used, which is a whole other piece about Eliyahu, because Eliyahu's essential failing was that he turned his back on Bnei Hashem. Look at the way he described what Bnei Yisrael are doing to Hashem. The famous Mechilta. Right? And so his comeuppance is that he is constantly reporting on Bnei. And here, watch what he says. So Rabbi Natan meets Eliyahu. By the way, Rabbi Natan is a contemporary of Rabbi, which means 100 years later. So he met Eliyahu and he said, "What did God do back then?" And it's when he got thrown out of the Beit Midrash and got told, "You don't get to vote." You know, trees nice, stream nice, walls not so happy. You don't get to vote. God was smiling and said, my children have defeated me. It's beautiful. Now the capper on this is that that means that God is happy that he got thrown out and that his children have decided to adopt the law he gave at Sinai and not allow him to interfere. Because God's interfering. He's making trees fly and streams move and walls crash and even announcing you should follow Rabbi Elazar, and he's getting booted out. So what's going on? So there's a lot of stuff to say about this. So we're not going to do that right now because it's already the time it is. But one important comment is when and where this happens is central for understanding of the function of the story.
This was God's plan. I mean, we established, providing the Torah to us, and the expectation is then we adjudicate. We work on it independent of God.
Right.
And that's the plan.
Except that that's a plan that shifted. That's why I point out the time. If you're in the Midbar meaning with Bnei Israel, and you have a halachic question, what do you do?
Ask Moshe.
Yes. And what does Moshe do? Ask God. Moshe does not sit and think about it. Five girls come up to Moshe and say, wait a second, our father died. So Moshe doesn't say, okay, let me look into Yesh Noichlin and see what the Mishnah says. Moshe says, hold on, I'll check. Vayakrev Moshe et Mishpatan lifnei Adonai. A few guys come to Moshe and say, hey, there's a Korban Pesach, but we're Tomei. And God tells him the Halacha. And a few people come to Moshe and say, Moshe, we're Tomei mate, and we can't bring the Korban. What do we do? He says, I don't know, I'll check. And God says, Korban Pesach Sheni. In other words, what's the operative model for new halacha in the desert? God. It's nevuah. It doesn't stop there. Throughout the entire period of the Nevi'im, you had a question. You went to a Navi, and your answer was given that way. And this is something that continues through the period, early period of the Mishnah. Is it through nevuah? Rabbi Yossi famously says, and we'll look at this in a couple of weeks if we continue this series, Rabbi Yossi famously says, and originally how would halacha work? You went to a Beit Din with a question, and if they had heard the traditional on the answer, they would tell you, and if not, they go to the next Beit Din up. They did not sit and argue it out based on analogy and based on reasoning, based on argumentation. They would say, we either have a tradition or we don't. If we don't, we move to the next Beit Din and go up and up and up and up and up until finally when you got to the Beit Din HaGadol Shel Yerushalayim, if they hadn't heard a tradition, then they'd have to reason it out and take a vote. And that was it. The mode of halachic discussion and decision-making that we're familiar with was absolutely foreign to them. Now today, you ask somebody a question, what do they do? They look it up. What if they don't find it? They try to find an analogy. They try to reason it out. I mean, you call up and up and up until finally get to the world expert. What does the world expert do? The world expert, whoever it is, on that particular topic, on chashmal b'shabbat, on halachic medical ethics, or whatever it is, what do they do ultimately? They try to reason it out based on other rulings. When did that change? Right here. Right. Right here. This is where it changed. This is the point where it changes. And why is this point so critical? Because what calamitous event has just taken place? Churban Beit HaMikdash. Churban Beit HaMikdash, the Chachamim assembled at Yavne had a momentous task before them. A huge, huge challenge. And that was to reformulate Judaism without a Mikdash. One of the first targets of that, of course, was the Seder. The Seder takes on a whole new face in Yavne. The Seder we have is Yavne's Seder. It's not Yerushalayim Seder, it's Yavne's Seder. As so much else about the way we live our life is formulated in the shadow of Churban Beit HaMikdash. And Yavne is sort of the catchword for that era, because it moves around. But we start in Yavne. And this is the story Chazal were telling about themselves, about how that shift happens. If the tree flies 200 years earlier, so that's the halacha. And trees don't fly 200 years later. We're now at the intersection where trees are still flying, and Rabbi Yeshua, who is the hero of Torah Shebaal Peh in this story, he's not the hero of the story, because we have to see the whole story, but in this part of the story, he's the hero of Torah Shebaal Peh, Rav Yeshua gets up and says, Lo v'shamayim hi, meaning anymore. Now it's shifted to Acharei Matot. We have to sit, we have to discuss it based on our own reasoning and understanding of the sources and not being wowed by miracles and not being frightened by trees flying. We have to make the decision. And so this is a core story that Chazal tell about themselves. What's, in a sense, more interesting is the context in which this story shows up, because it will surprise you. But we'll look at that next week.